Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary L. Mikva presiding. Case number 21-1119, William P. D'Alessandro versus Judith Quinn D'Alessandro.
Thank you, Darren. Good afternoon, gentlemen. We are going to proceed this afternoon. You will each have 20 minutes. Before you start, we start counting time. We're going to ask you each to introduce yourselves, and whoever's representing the appellant, please let us know if you'd like to reserve any of your 20 minutes for rebuttal. So beginning with the appellant's counsel, please just tell us your names and who you represent.
Kevin Lyons, representing the plaintiffs. And I would like 15 minutes for the argument, 5 for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, terrific. Counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is Christopher Gallinari on behalf of the appellee, Chuak and Texas.
Okay. Mr. Lyons, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court. Counselor, I'm Kevin Lyons. Here with me today is attorney Stephanie Kapolsky, and we represent the plaintiffs who are the D'Alessandro heirs. At times during this argument, I may be referring to the D'Alessandro heirs as plaintiffs, but the fact that they're the heirs of the decedent should not be lost upon this court. The D'Alessandro heirs are appealing the dismissal with prejudice order that was entered by the trial court in favor of the defendant law firm Chuak and Texan under 2619A5 as being time barred. As a result, the standard of review is de novo. To the extent that this court desires to apply an abuse of discretion standard on the portion of the argument that relates only to the fraudulent concealment tolling, the attorney statute repose, the D'Alessandro heirs argue that the trial court ruling was not only arbitrary, but unreasonable. And the key question that this court should be asking itself is, why didn't Chuak produce the 2010 and 2011 trust documents?
I'm going to stop you for 1 second. So what you're saying is, on the issue of whether the trial court should consider those fraudulent concealment arguments, that's where you're saying there was an abuse of discretion, that the court should have considered them. And then I think you will argue also found the meritorious. But
that is correct, Your Honor, though I do point out that in our response brief to the motion to dismiss that was filed on page 8, we actually argued before the court Chuak purposely withheld information relating to the various trust documents, and this information in an attempt to conceal its participation in Quinn's scheme and conspiracy. So I believe the de novo standard still applies. However, counsel has raised the abuse of discretion standard as possibly applying to the fraudulent concealment tolling the statute of repose. Okay.
All right.
So I still contest. I still believe it should be de novo.
I would say on the merits it's de novo. On whether the court should have considered it or you forfeited it, it's perhaps abuse of discretion. Okay.
And just to clarify, counsel, based on what you just said, and that was my understanding as well. But the 2012 trust agreement was the only one that was originally tendered. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then the others were tendered after they responded to the subpoena. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
And the key question, of course, is why did Chuak wait until the 2-year statute of repose to actually respond to the subpoena and produce the 2010 and the 2011 trusts? If the statute of limitations was 6 months and it had run under the Probate Act, and if Chuak thought that they were in the clear, then they should have produced the 2010 and the 2011 trust at that point in time, because the heirs had asked for it. If Chuak was protecting Judy, as they claim, then why not produce the subpoena response after Judy was already sued within the statute of limitations?
Well, you didn't issue the subpoena until 5/10/18, which was after the statute of limitations had already run, correct?
That is correct, Justice. The subpoena issued to Chuak was in May of 2018.
So are you saying that Chuak had some obligation to make a disclosure to you prior to the time you issued the subpoena?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because Chuak was representing the decedent and his intent, and the D'Alessandro heirs were the third party beneficiaries of the services being provided by Chuhok and Texan to the decedent. Of course, in hindsight, we now know from the 2010 and 2011 trusts that the D'Alessandro heirs were in fact beneficiaries, significant beneficiaries in fact. And in the 2012 trust, they were removed and reduced to contingent remainderman beneficiaries.
Let me ask you a question. Did you have the 2010 and 2011 trusts at the time you drafted your first amended complaint?
No, Your Honor. That first amended complaint was against Judy to address additional allegations and causes of action that the original complaint did not adequately flush out, I felt.
But you did not have the earlier trust documents?
No, I did not have the 2010 or 2011 trust documents until December 24th of 2018.
When Chuhok was filed.
Yes, when Chuhok produced.
And what did those documents give you that made it clear to you that you had a claim against Chuhok?
Well, several things. First of all, in 2010, the 2010 trust left the D'Alessandro heirs $20 million. Then there was a marital trust where the money that was over the $20 million would then be used for the benefit of the wife, Judy. That money, then after Judy's death, would go to the plaintiffs, the D'Alessandro heirs, after she died. And how we know that there would have been money left is because there were restrictions in the 2010 trust where Judy could not use the principal of the other trust without having to check with Northern Trust, who was a corporate fiduciary. So in the 2010 trust, we have a couple of measures here that protect the D'Alessandro heirs. Not only do they get $20 million up front under a trust for their benefit, making them direct beneficiaries, but more importantly, there's a co-trustee involved who's there to keep an eye on Judy, and not only keep an eye, but has the final say. So any money that Judy wanted to go into on the principal of that sub-trust after the decedent passed would be under the watchful eye of Northern Trust.
Okay. So it got worse and worse for your clients with each reiteration. But how does that put them on notice that the law firm has liability?
Because any attorney that drafts three trusts, wherein the 2010 trust went to $20 million, the 2011 trust, that's very important. And here's why. Because the 2010 trust gave $20 million to the family trust. The 2011 trust gave $18.25 million. The decrease isn't what's significant here. What's significant here is that plaintiff Michelle, who would have gotten 6.23 million, she went down to 250,000. That's just a few short months after the 2010 trust.
Okay. I'm going to come back to my same question. Sure. What put you on notice that the law firm has liability for this?
Because as alleged in the complaint, and the allegations are to be taken true, as well as the standard of practice and care, the law firm did not adequately represent the decedent's interest and the decedent's intent. The decedent's intent was thwarted. So, and they knew that, and they certainly should have known that. And how we know that now is because in 2010 and 2011, where they would have gotten a benefit, they didn't get one in 2012. And for some unknown reason, the two boys in 2011, their percentage increase went up. They went from 6 2/3 to 7.5 million. Any law firm that's drafting that document, you have to ask yourself why an 87-year-old multimillionaire who just married a woman who was 30 years his junior would suddenly switch his estate plan for the third time in 3.5 years to make an unusual change and then add a no contest provision. So in that 2011, we leave in Northern Trust and there's a no contest provision, which presumably is there because Michelle went from 6 2/3 to $250,000. So that's how we know and how they knew that they should have been sued and were going to get sued. And their actions speak louder than words, though their words, they admitted that they filed the 6-month, the probate was done solely to start the 6-month statute of limitations. Now they're going to argue that that was the benefit for Judy, but it also benefited them, didn't it? And after that 6-month period, we look at their actions as well. And the only reason I'm focusing on their actions is because the complaint I feel is pretty clean. I feel the allegations are well pled, and I could easily rely on that because this is a 2619. But what's imperative and I think important here is to watch what they did. They fought tooth and nail on that subpoena. They played every game in the book that they could to push this thing out.
Mr. Lyons, can I interrupt you for a second? I'd like to focus in on the relation back theory. If we then focus on the allegations of the original complaint, you know, the theory against Judy, and I think the theory against the law firm is that William was incompetent, that he was a victim of undue influence. And against the law firm, the law firm aided and abetted Judy in accomplishing what Judy wanted to accomplish. So what is it, if you could, you know, explain to us why the allegations in the original complaint would have put a reasonable person on notice that it had exposure, but for the, lack of knowledge about that law firm's involvement, that it had exposure to liability here. I think your best case is the Borcher case. So if you could speak to it in the context of that case.
Sure, I believe the Borcher case was the eavesdropping case. And that was the situation where the plaintiff was unaware of the two defendants that were ended up being added and the case related back. The trial court in this case pointed to the original complaint as if the original complaint was what would be controlling or dispositive in a relation back doctrine analysis, and it's not. But I think the
Why not? Because
the three prongs of the relation back are whether the statute of limitation had not expired when the first complaint was filed. The second, and we'll get to this in a bit, was that the defendant received notice of the suit within the statute of limitations and knew.
Wait, that's the only prong that's at issue. So if you could just focus in on that.
I will do that. I just want to point out that the third prong is that the cause of action in the amended complaint grew out of or arose out of the same transaction. And they admitted that. And that's important because it gets to the second point. In the original complaint, if we look at the paragraphs that we set forth in the reply, the original complaint said that the restatement was forged, that the decedent didn't execute it, that Judith brought the decedent to Chuhok's office to change his trust document to her advantage, that the decedent did not have capacity when the 2012 restatement was executed, and the fraud of having the decedent change his trust left Judith with virtually all of the trust assets, and the actions of Judith were done with the intent to defraud the plaintiffs. Those are paragraphs in the original complaint, 26, 14, 39, and 43, respectively. The second amended complaint.
Oh, so let me just stop you there. The trial judge said that that was not sufficient. All that said is, you know, that's where the that the parties met at the law firm. Why is that determination incorrect?
Because the analysis under the second prong, first, we talk about mistake. They argue that mistake is a mistake, but clearly in Zlotev and which followed Krupski, the U.S. Supreme Court, that mistake is inadequate knowledge or a lack of knowledge, which is exactly what happened in this case. We didn't have the knowledge of what they did to the 2010 and 2011 trust. And we only got that knowledge after they had produced a response to the subpoena on the 2-year deadline. So that's as to mistake. As to the new or should have known portion, the allegations of the complaint of the SAC actually say they knew. So you have to take those allegations as true. But more importantly, their conduct, again, shows that they...
The allegations of the original complaint says who knew what?
No, the allegations of the second amended complaint.
No, I'd like you to focus in on the original complaint.
So the original complaint said that the decedent did not have the capacity... Well, as to the law firm, Judith brought the decedent to... Blank's office, Chuck Texan's law office, to change his trust documents to her advantage. That's in paragraph 26. So the knowledge isn't required on the plaintiff's side, on the heir's side. The knowledge is on the defendant's side and what they knew and what they should have known. And they did know, and they should have known. On page 25 of our appellate brief, I go into a little analogy where if different law firms had drafted the 2010, 2011, and 2012 trust, there'd be different arguments going on, there'd be different facts. Under these facts, we have one firm doing the 10, 11, and 12 trusts that make significant changes by the end, and actually significant changes each step of the way that slowly leads this man to execute documents that leave his heirs with nothing. They knew.
You know, I'm going to try to just very quickly summarize your argument. I'm sorry, Justice Walker, but your argument is that William was incompetent. He went to the law firm to sign away, to basically disinherit, at least partially disinherit, the heirs, and that the law firm prepared the documents or was involved in the preparation of the documents, and it therefore should have known that, but for the lack of knowledge of the plaintiff about the law firm's involvement, that it would have been named as a defendant. Is that the gist of it?
It's the gist, but the focus cannot be on our intent that was in the original complaint. The focus is on the defendants. And that's really, I think, where the trial court erred, because what we have here is...
The focus is on the party to be named, which is Chuhan.
Which is Chuhan.
Okay.
That's right. And there is, they withheld the 2010 and 2011 trust. Why did they do that? Why did they not produce it sooner? And not only that, the allegations of the complaint actually say that they knew what was going on. The decedent lacked capacity. The decedent, there's fraud, torturous interference, undue influence, and lack of capacity. And the law firm that's drafting these documents each step of the way, they absolutely have an obligation to their client, the decedent, as well as the D'Alessandro heirs. So that's really the relation back doctrine, is because the mistake is a lack of knowledge. That lack of knowledge is a result of their conduct. Their conduct being not just the acts that allowed the decedent's will to be replaced, but then they didn't produce any of the documents. They didn't give the D'Alessandro heirs, and they didn't speak when they had a duty to speak. The D'Alessandro heirs approached them and asked them for a copy of not just the 2012 trust, but everything dating back. And they intentionally only gave the 2012 trust.
Why does the law firm have an obligation to the heirs if the law firm is representing William, and William is at least partially disinheriting the heirs?
Well, the attorneys actually owe a fiduciary duty to also the intended beneficiaries. And clearly now, as we alleged in the complaint, which is to be taken as true, but now that we know from the 2010 and 2011 trust, the D'Alessandro heirs were the intended beneficiaries of Dr. D'Alessandro's estate. That intention was thwarted, of course, by 2012. So they absolutely in 2016 had a duty to speak because they knew what had happened. And mind you, in 2012, that 2012 trust doesn't just give Judy everything. It removes Northern Trust as the corporate trustee.
I'm going to cut you off because I think Justice Walker has a question, and you are technically out of time.
He was going right into it right there. That's what I was pointing out.
Okay,
was that Northern Trust was removed in the 2012 amendment. So that he can continue on. I'm good.
So the 2012 trust, it did a number of things. One of which was it removed Northern Trust as a co-trustee, which would have at least been a watchful eye. It gave the entire marital trust to Judy. It made Judy sole trustee. She had complete withdrawal rights. And what that means is Judy, as trustee, can give everything to Judy as beneficiary for no reason. She could transfer, gift, or spend. On the sub-trust, the credit shelter trust, the tax credit shelter trust, she gets the income no matter what. And on the principal, she's the one that gets to make a decision as to whether she needs the money for health, education, maintenance, or support. And here's the kicker. In their 2012 trust that Chuhan drafted, Judy doesn't have to consider her other sources of income in making that determination as trustee for her own benefit. But the real sad thing, and this is really, I think, the icing on the cake and what makes this case personal and why Bill's intent was proven not to have been met in 2012. Judy got all of the personal property. These kids got nothing. They didn't. Judy got the rugs, the paintings, the car.
You are out of time. Unless Justice Walker or Justice Taylor has a question, I'm going to cut you off.
Thank you.
May I proceed, Justice McMillan? Thank you very much. My name is Christopher Gallinari. I represent Chuhak and Texan. A number of things. Counsel for appellants has repeatedly referred to a two-year deadline. The statute of limitations and repose that is applicable here is not a two-year deadline, but a much shorter deadline than that.
I think we all understand that concept.
Very well. Justice Taylor asked counsel for appellants about the Borchers case and said that he believed that was perhaps plaintiff's strongest case. But as we say in our brief, in Borchers, the plaintiff's claim against the vice president of her former corporate employer related back to her initial complaint against the employer, quote, and unknown persons. So at the time of the initial complaint, there's an objective manifestation of intent by the plaintiff in that case to hold somebody other than the employer responsible.
There's language in that case about lack of knowledge as to the role that people played in the wrongdoing. There's language in that case that says that, and that's what.
And here, plaintiffs filed their initial complaint attaching a complete copy of the 2012 trust amendment with knowledge that Chuhak and Texan was involved in the estate planning and in the preparation of that document and did not objectively manifest any intent to hold them responsible, even though they knew that the law firm had a role in the preparation of that complaint. And as the appellate court has said in Wahlstatt, a plaintiff has not made a mistake if the allegations reveal that he or she intended to sue one party for misconduct, but after the time limitation period has passed, decides to add an additional defendant, not contemplated in the original complaint, who may also have been liable. Rather, 616D applies where plaintiff's allegations and the record show that the new defendant was the party responsible for the claimed misconduct in the original complaint. We don't have that.
Mr. Gallinari, I want to ask you a question, and I want to sort of put it in layperson terms. As I understand the gist of Mr. Lyon's argument, William was suffering dementia. He was incompetent. He was taken to the Chuhak firm, and at the Chuhak firm, documents were signed that essentially partially disinherited the heirs. Why is that not sufficient to put an objective person on notice that, but for the lack of information about, the role, the specific role of the firm, that they would have been sued? Why is that not sufficient?
Well, I think that here it's important to look at what plaintiffs alleged in their initial complaint versus what they alleged in their first amended complaint.
Right, and I think what I had just said are allegations from the original complaint. I think.
Right. And to answer that question, I think it's important to look at the distinction between what plaintiffs filed in their initial complaint when they were represented by prior attorneys and what they alleged in their first amended complaint after they retained Mr. Lyons in his firm. What we see is a deliberate litigation strategy where the plaintiffs in filing their initial complaint are not adding to their will trust or a will contest or trust contest count. any claim for undue influence or tortious interference with testamentary relationships, no claim for money damages against any defendant at all. All they are seeking is the equitable relief of setting aside the instruments that they believe are improper. And based upon plaintiff's decision to proceed in litigation in that manner, with knowledge of Chuhak's involvement with respect to that trust, which, as Mr. Lyons admits, is the instrument that he alleges disinherits the plaintiffs and gives Judith D'Alessandro powerful powers that she previously, in even the 2010 and 2011 instrument, she did not have. So with respect to the 2012 trust restatement, there's nothing that would indicate to a reasonable attorney that the attorney would have been sued if not for a mistake as to its identity. And that's the standard under 616D. We don't have that here.
But here's what we do have, Mr. Gallinari, is that it's about the role that they played and when did the plaintiff learn of the role that Chuhak played. Originally, they only had the 2012 restatement. But once they received the 2010 and 2011 restatement, they now had more information. And now they had reason to believe that Mr. Chuhak's role was greater than what they previously thought it was. And then that combined with, and this is a question that I have for you, Mr. Chuhak filed and opened a probate estate for an estate that had no assets.
True.
Because the trust is not an asset of the estate. So let me start by saying, just tell us the reason that your client opened the probate estate. And then I want you to come back to the question of the role that they're alleging Mr. Chuhak played.
I think that Mr. Broad has told the probate court the reason they opened the estate was because after the meetings between plaintiff's attorneys and Chuhak and Texan, when in April of 2017, they didn't just make a demand on Chuhak. They had their own lawyers who went to meet with Chuhak and in an adversarial meeting because they weren't relying upon Chuhak at that meeting. They had their own lawyers.
And just to be clear, Mr. Geller, the Chuhak had already made an offer of $4 million to the heirs. Is that correct?
Recall that in the record. I'm not sure about that, Your Honor.
Okay, but I definitely read it that there was an offer of $4 million. Okay, that's fine.
And if so, I don't know at what point that was made. But the extent that such an offer was communicated, again, it was communicated on behalf of their client, Judith D'Alessandro. Under Rule 1.6, Chuhak and Texan can't divulge information to the heirs unless their client, Judith D'Alessandro, approves them doing this. Mr. Lyons has said that Chuhak owed a duty to the heirs because they prepared estate planning documents for their parents and that they were the intended beneficiary of those estate planning documents. Now, there is case law saying that the duty of care can be enforced by the beneficiaries, but there's no case law saying that the entire fiduciary duty is applied to them as well. The fiduciary duty applies to the attorney-client relationship. It applied to Mr. D'Alessandro, and then it applied to Judith D'Alessandro after he died. Chuhak and Texan could not have given additional documents after Mr. D'Alessandro's death without the approval of their client under Rule 1.6. And I think that even the Meritern Partners case that appellants cite to in their reply brief say defendants knew or should have foreseen that a breach of the requisite duty of care would result in a loss for both Meritern and the outside investors. But in response to the citation of that case, I would draw the court's attention to, I think this is the best case that really summarizes it. There's a Seventh Circuit case called ROPPO, R-O-P-P-O, 869 Fed 3rd 568 from 2017. And it summarizes the Illinois law on this point. It was a decision by Justice Ripple. And at page 592, it says, in Illinois, an attorney generally owes a duty of care only to his client and not to third parties. This general rule is meant to protect the attorney-client relationship. Since an attorney must represent his client with zeal and undivided loyalty in adversarial matters, he cannot have fiduciary duties to third parties, which may interfere with this duty to his client and leave him vulnerable to liability.
Your position that the firm could not have disclosed the earlier drafts of the trust agreements before they had either the subpoena or agreement of their client?
Yes.
Okay.
But even more importantly, for purposes of what they should have known about whether or not from that complaint, they should have known that they would have been sued. There's no precedent that supports the argument that where you are then later asserting additional claims against one defendant, that you then have the ability to relate back those new additional claims to another defendant under 616D. What Mr. Lyons is trying to do is he's saying he not only has a claim to set aside the 2012 restatement, he has a claim to set aside the 2010 and the 2011, although I don't know that he's actually saying that, because he's saying here the children would have gotten $20 million under the 2010 instrument. They would have gotten $16 million under the 2011 instrument. He alleges that he wants to set those instruments aside, but what he's saying here on argument seems to indicate something else, that those 2010 and 2011 documents are not as nefarious as he alleges them to be in his complaint. Be that as it may, there's no appellate support for the proposition that once you add to your will and trust contest claim with respect to the 2012 documents, and you try to set aside also the 2011 and 2010 documents, that you then can add an additional defendant under 616D2. There's no support for that. All of the cases that find relation back are either cases where the plaintiff manifests an intent in its complaint to hold the defendant that he names or some other unknown people responsible for his injury.
Mr. Gilroy, Mr. Lyons is arguing that they did do that in their complaint when they mentioned that all of this happened because I'll call her Judith because that's what it says here in the complaint, that Judith took the decedent to the office for the purpose of getting these amendments done. And I guess if I were a lawyer and I saw that in a complaint, I'd be concerned that they're naming me as all of this having happened at my office.
Well, there could be an allegation that refers to you as a witness to somebody else's misconduct, but there's nothing in the complaint that evinces an intent to hold that witness responsible for the defendant's conduct. There's only—
So Mr. Gallinari, can I just interrupt 1 second? There's also an allegation that, William's signature was forged. So can't a reasonable inference be drawn from those allegations that, hey, we as a law firm, this is happening under our watch, we have some aiding and abetting exposure here?
No, because it wasn't alleged. It wasn't claimed. There's no claim for aiding and abetting. There's no claim for—
No, it wasn't alleged in the original complaint, but what is alleged is that that Judith took William to the CHUHEC office to change his trust documents to her advantage, that William lacked capacity on that day, that William did not execute the 2012 restatement, and that William's signature was forged. So based on those allegations, isn't there enough here to invoke the relation back doctrine?
No, because those allegations demonstrate to CHUHAC that plaintiffs could not have misunderstood a crucial fact about their identity because they were the law firm where those documents were signed. The standard is that CHUHAC...
So in other words, your argument is that these allegations demonstrate that the plaintiffs already knew of CHUHAC's involvement and that nothing that came afterwards, nothing that they discovered afterwards from the response to the subpoena gave them any more information about it.
I think that's correct. And I think that's how the circuit court reasoned it. And I think the circuit court was correct because, they rely heavily on Zlotev, and Zlotev says, a prospective defendant who legitimately believed that the limitations period had passed without any attempt to sue him has a strong interest in repose. But then the appellate court continues, repose would be a windfall for a prospective defendant who understood or who should have understood that he escaped suit during the limitations period only because plaintiff misunderstood a crucial fact about his identity. And what you are saying, Justice Taylor, is that plaintiff did not misunderstand a crucial fact about CHUHAC's identity. It was right there in the complaint, the facts about where these alleged acts occurred and the deliberate litigation strategy revealed in the initial complaint, not to hold all of the people who may have been involved jointly and severally liable for money damages under various theories in tort, as Mr. Lyons did when he filed his first amended complaint against Judy, but only the equitable relief to set the instrument aside. And when you see that, and when you see that complaint and it doesn't go beyond that, you don't think that you were not sued because of a mistake about your identity. You think you weren't sued because that's the litigation strategy that plaintiffs and their counsel at the time decided to pursue.
But Mr. Gallinari, you agree though, but you agree that they did learn new information once the CHUHAC responded to the subpoena, correct? You just believe that that information was inconsequential, right?
I think that I think that plaintiffs had sufficient information and CHUHAC had sufficient information from what plaintiffs alleged in their initial complaint not to believe that they were not sued only because of a mistake. That's the standard. Based upon what plaintiffs knew at the time of the initial complaint and based upon what they chose to do and what relief they sought.
But isn't the standard whether or not based upon the initial complaint, CHUHAC had information to believe that he could have some exposure? Is that the question?
No, I don't believe so. I think you look to the objective manifestation of the complaint, not to what additional claims may be alleged later in the case. For instance, in McCarthy, the plaintiffs later added claim against fraternal organization defendants for supposedly having encouraged plaintiffs' suspension from the fraternity. Didn't relate back to their timely claims for defamation against individual fraternity members because it's a different claim. And the same thing is Smiley, which is also cited too in our brief.
You're just about out of time. And I want you to briefly address fraudulent concealment before you run completely out of time.
Thank you. Well, there's a number of reasons that we state in our brief. Fraudulent concealment does not apply to the addition of a defendant. And that's what plaintiffs are trying to do here. It doesn't apply when you don't know the extent of your injury, as we argue in our brief. It doesn't apply here because whatever we produced in response to the subpoena in 2018 was outside the period of time by which there was any valid claim
But counsel, can it be that there's a period that starts when they sit down and meet with you and continues through to the production and the subpoena where you're concealing everything that happened prior to the ultimate trust documents.
But not when they have their own separate lawyers and they're meeting with us, because under Chicago Park District versus Kenwood, it's the prevailing rule that as between persons sustaining a fiduciary or trust or other confidential relationship toward each other, that you have the duty to speak for purposes of statute of limitations purposes. Just because there may be a duty of care to not negligently draft the estate planning documents, that's separate and apart from whether or not you have an affirmative duty to disclose under a fiduciary relationship when you represent Judith and the plaintiffs come to you in an adversarial posture represented by their own attorney.
Well, you also tell them, don't you, that the only relevant document is the current trust document. You affirmatively tell them that. That's all that's relevant.
Which is the truth, because after that document is executed, the previous documents are no longer of any legal import.
All right. Any questions from either anyone else on the panel on the fraudulent concealment? All right. Mr. Lyons, rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. In Zlotev, this appellate court found that a plaintiff's original complaint is no longer dispositive because mistake is a lack of knowledge. If a plaintiff doesn't have that knowledge, how could a plaintiff ever plead that in a complaint?
Counsel, I think you are mixing your two arguments, to tell you the truth. I think you're mixing up fraudulent concealment and relation back. Relation back is based on what notice the defendant is put on by virtue of your initial complaint. And what else they knew that's not in your complaint is really not relevant, I don't think, to that doctrine. I've not seen a single case that suggests that they, because they know that they may have done something wrong, the claim relates back.
I respectfully disagree. Counsel quoted McCarthy. If McCarthy was to be construed as inconsistent with Krupski, this court in Zlotev would stated that it would have departed from it. Zlotev followed Krupski, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, which clarified the relation back doctrine and rejected the focus on what the plaintiff knew or should have known, and that mistake includes a lack of knowledge. The facts that give rise to the knowledge of Chuhak, or that they should have known, are the same facts that give rise to the reason why fraudulent concealment tolls the statute of repose in this case. But those same facts apply both equally to the relation back doctrine and the fraudulent concealment. So I think that is the point that I would like to leave. In terms of the attorney-client privilege, counsel referenced Rappo, which is a Seventh Circuit case that's inapplicable. It wasn't in their brief, but I was able to take a quick look at it here. And I think that what the court should really focus on, of course, is the Illinois State Supreme Court's ruling in Dehart. And in Dehart, they say that generally the attorney-client privilege survives the client's death. That's normal, but a different rule applies, however, with respect to a will. In such a case, there's only a temporary privilege. Where an attorney prepares a will for a client and witnesses the same, the privilege only exists during the lifetime of the client. The rationale behind this limited exception to the privilege is that a decedent would, if one could ask him, forego the privilege so that the distribution scheme that he actually intended can be given effect. And that's Dehart v. Dehart, 2013, Illinois, 114137. And I believe that's at paragraph 69. And the second point, in terms of what was the duty that Chuhak would have to give, we cited in our reply brief the case of DeLuna and Meridum. And Chuhak had a duty to disclose because they were retained by the decedent to make sure his intent was met in his estate planning. And we didn't know about the 2010 and 2011 until well after the 6-month period and on the eve and on the day, really, of the statute of repose. The D'Alessandro heirs were intended beneficiaries of that estate planning service. And thus the services provided by Chuhak. Chuhak therefore had a fiduciary duty, including a duty to speak. Just because Chuhak decided to represent Judy after the decedent passed, whether that was something that is wise or not, they ended up doing it. That's on them. They don't have a waiver of conflicts letter. Their engagement was dual representation. We absolutely, and that should and have so far, gotten communications between the decedent and Chuhak, because we had a right to him because we're the heirs. So,
Mr. Lyons, can I ask you to respond to Mr. Gallinari's argument? I had asked Mr. Gallinari about the allegations that you do have in your original complaint. And those, again, just to remind you, are that Judith brought William to Chuhak's office to change his trust to her advantage, that William lacked capacity, that William did not execute the 2012 restatement, and that William's signature was forged. I asked him, well, why wouldn't that have put an objective person in Chuhak's position on notice or given knowledge that they had potential exposure here? And his response was that, in fact, the allegations demonstrate that the plaintiffs had wide knowledge of Chuhak's role, but as a matter of strategy, elected not to sue Chuhak, and therefore the relation back doctrine does not apply. What's your response?
Well, I would imagine that if plaintiff's counsel had the knowledge of the 2010 and 2011 trust, their allegations would have included that in their complaint within the 6-month period. But more importantly, what we're talking really about here is policy and public policy. If heirs are supposed to sue every estate planning attorney who drafted the last estate planning document, then we are going to have a lot of estate planning attorneys getting sued, and we're going to have a lot of plaintiff lawyers representing those heirs getting hit with 137s. So we have to have a good faith basis in fact and in law. When you're going to sue a law firm, you better be right. So Mr. Gallinari's argument actually defeats itself, confirms that they had notice. We didn't have the 2010 and 2011 trust. It was, quite frankly, we were shocked that they were involved and saw the documents that we saw, which is why we filed the action that we did, and why, even if we get to a point where the relation back doctrine didn't exist or the fraudulent concealment didn't exist, we have equitable tolling and equitable estoppel. From an equitable estoppel standpoint, they can't stop us from bringing a suit against them because they decided to not produce the information until the day the statute of repose. And from an equitable tolling standpoint, let's say that both sides did nothing wrong, that Chuhak had done nothing wrong here. Well, what we have is Chuhak's negligence, where they didn't meet the intent of the grantor. Now, where does that fall down? Who has to bear that? Why should the plaintiff have a miscarriage of justice? And the whole purpose of the relation back doctrine, as this court has found, is to get to the merits of the case. And that is what should have happened.
All right, counsel, thank you both. I think you're out of time, unless there are other questions from anyone. All right, thank you both. Very interesting case, and we will take it under advisement, and we will hear from us in due course.